Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 30th of March, 2020, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're also joined by David Scott, bringing us northern exposure from north of the border. Well, the topic, of course, goes on, but it's such an important topic, we need to get straight into it.
Well, apparently there's nothing else going on. So anyway, latest stats then, number of cases up to 735,276 globally. Number of deaths, 34,813. Number of recoveries, 156,137. That gives us 544,326 active cases at the moment, of which 516,117 are mild, and 28,209 are serious or critical. Now, the government announced on Friday, Brian, that they would be creating three new test labs for COVID-19, and apparently NHS staff will be the first in line for a new coronavirus testing program. So they have called in industry, philanthropy, universities to scale up testing. So Thermo Fisher Scientific, Amazon, Boots, Royal Mail and Randox, alongside the Wellcome Trust and top UK universities, are going to boost the testing capacity. They're going to create the first lab, which is going to get its validation today. And the other two will be brought online as soon as possible. And the first samples to be processed by the labs will be taken from frontline health workers. And as the lab capacity increases, they're going to take them from other essential workers, not just frontline health workers. So that's got to be good news, Brian.
It's incredible news, Mike, because of what we were doing 2 weeks ago when we started to ask what testing was being done on NHS staff to see how many of them had actually got coronavirus, how many of them had died, and of course the risks posed to patients if you don't know who of the NHS staff have got the virus. So we'll recap here briefly, but we like to do things properly, so here we contacted Public Health England and we said basically what testing is being carried out. Could you provide a percentage breakdown and actual numbers of NHS medical and health related staff that have been diagnosed as having coronavirus? Well, the response was that this wasn't a question for them and it was a question for National Health Service England. So that was a gentle go away, but at least they pointed me in a direction. And so we went to NHS England and we basically asked them the same question. Please, can you tell me the number of NHS staff, full and part-time for UK that contracted COVID-19 to date? It would be helpful if you can also provide some form of statistical breakdown in mild or serious infection and deaths. And I understand from Public Health England that I should apply to you for this data. Well, what did we get? We don't hold this data. All inquiries relating to case numbers are being handled by the Department for Health and Social Care. And last week we reported that we emailed them asking them for the data and a reply was pending. But of course, we can now tell you we never did receive any reply. Now, today, we were astonished to find this document. So we've got NHS England actually saying that they've now started testing. And basically, we've also got a quote in here from, bear with me, I need to catch up on the slides. This is an eyesight issue. Where are we? Somewhere here, we should be able to do it. Sorry, we seem to have a slight problem on the slides. Okay, I'll take you through this as best
that's
I can.
So Simon Stevens is who's on screen at the moment, Brian.
Right, so Simon Stevens, and he's saying that he's able to confirm on Friday that a testing program to support the NHS staff can now begin this week. So when we asked, they said they didn't have any data, but not to worry because it can start this week. And the letter went on, and it was signed by three people. So you can take this directly off the screen so that you can see exactly what we've got here. But let's see what the three signatories had to say. And this is the first lady, Amanda Pritchard, Chief Operating Officer of NHS England. And she says in the letter to the Trust that they should identify staff or household members who need to be tested, with a particular focus on testing the suspected coronavirus sufferer in a quarantined household, which is shared with a key NHS staff member. And they're asking that you initially allocate up to 15% of your daily testing capacity for this purpose. So all of a sudden, we've got a rush to get NHS people tested. But it seems to have taken the UK column to ask the key question, why wasn't this happening? She goes on, she says, work together to arrange where and how sample testing should take place, appreciating that this may involve standing back up previously used community and drive-through testing facilities. Well, that is saying that testing facilities were shut down. And I think we have to ask Mike, if they were shut down, why were they shut down when now we see the need to actually be testing? So is this confusion and chaos, or has it taken the UK column to blow the lid off this one? So she goes on, for example, if 100 patients per day are swabbed in your trust, you're able to swab a further 15 cases with the aim of releasing NHS staff back to work. Regional teams may request a small proportion of these 15 cases are allocated outside the trust. And finally, in the letter, she says, we'd like to reassure you that we're pushing hard to get the NHS access to more staff testing in the days to come. But we want to make a proper start now rather than wait for new types of tests or test providers. So when we initially emailed Public Health England, the response they gave was not true, because clearly they must have known that actually no proper testing was going on. And this was also one of the signatories of the letter, Stephen Powis. He's the National Medical Director for NHS England. He said every citizen in the United Kingdom must play a part if the number of deaths from coronavirus are to be kept below 20,000. If we can keep deaths below 20,000, we will have done very well in this epidemic. If we do ensure we are to stay within the NHS capacity, everyone has a part to play and it can work. And finally, this lady was also quoted, and we've tracked her through to her Twitter page. And these were two key tweets that she made. This one is March the 27th. Not being able to offer access to speedy testing and results for all critical staff is so frustrating. And whilst I understand why Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock have been tested, it only goes to reinforce said frustration. And then in a further tweet, she says on the 28th of March that she's back in the saddle after Sainsbury's soup and cleaning up the back garden, and staff testing really is coming, like really, a small step in the fight against COVID-19, but one giant leap for the NHS. And another NHS manager actually posted that in response. Hey Sarah, we at Morecambe Bay NHS Trust have been testing staff for a few weeks now. It has made a huge impact on staff return. So what is going on here? We are simply not getting any coherent picture from the three key agencies. But this means that basically we've got NHS staff who may well be infected still in contact with patients. Why should we pay attention? Have a look at this BBC headline where we've got one of three hospital doctors who have died as a result of COVID-19. And we're just going to come up and say, well, actually, we still can't get answers to these questions from either Public Health England, NHS England, and the Department of Health. But on the death of the doctors, here was Stephen Powis again, and he's saying that Dr. Harani's death was a stark reminder to the whole country. We must all take this crisis seriously. The NHS is a family, and we all feel deeply at the loss of any of our colleagues. So he's jumping straight in on the deaths, but his organisation has completely failed to carry out the tests to establish what the risks are within the NHS. So a lot of questions to be answered there. Do have a look at that document, freeze it on the screen. Apologies for the slight glitch in the slides.
David, let's bring you into the programme and just ask what your thoughts are on this. It does seem like an incredible situation that, bearing in mind Brian showed a document that was published some time ago last week, that document saying that it was critical that first response staff were tested and that people understood exactly what the situation was within infection within the first responder staff themselves, and yet that apparently hasn't been happening. You're muted. Right. Okay, David. Look, I can't hear you. So we'll move on. Right.
We're having a special day.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to this now. Last week we were highlighting the fact that, of course, we don't actually know what the death rate is with COVID-19 because we don't know how many people are actually infected. So the death rate can appear to be higher than it might seem. And we were showing the statistics from Euromomo, which is the European Union's backed website that highlights the number of excess deaths that there are by comparison with what happens normally. And what I just wanted to do is to show you this particular graphic that Euromomo produces, which is showing the situation up until March the 22nd. As you can see there, there are no excess deaths as far as Euromomo is concerned in most parts of the countries, most numbers of the countries where they actually have statistics, with the exception of Italy. But what I wanted to do is just to roll back through time here. So as we go backwards through time, you can see how these statistics change. And you can see that on several occasions, in fact, quite a number of occasions over the past couple of years, we have seen countries coming in and out of time periods where there were what were considered significant high excess deaths. So I just want to say once again, Brian, that here we have a situation where we have locked the country down and effectively stopped the economy of the country on the basis of an illness which is spreading, which doesn't seem to be having any broader effect than we have seen at many periods in the past. Yeah. So as you're about to see, when this reaches 26, this is in fact week 5, 2017, most of Europe had very high mortality, excess mortality during that period. That was, of course, the flu pandemic at the time. We're not seeing most of Europe at this point in dark blue as we are there. It remains to be seen what happens over the next couple of weeks. But my point is we've seen very high excess mortality several times in the past in the last 5 years, and we haven't carried out the response that we seem to be carrying out at the moment.
That's correct. And we could also bring in the example of the mid-staff hospital crisis a few years ago, when experts were absolutely warning about unexplained excess deaths. They wrote a very damning report that was saying that tens of thousands of elderly people would have died by these problems. But what did the government do? It brought in another team, the so-called common purpose team, which rewrote the report, and it all drifted away. So the contrast is really very strange indeed.
Now, last week we received an email from a UK column viewer which said, "Dear Brian and Mike, hope this finds you both well. A good friend of mine's dad died last week, elderly man. He was sent home on Saturday saying he was fit enough. His daughter took him back to hospital on the Sunday as he wasn't well, not coughing though, and he later died. The family believe it was sepsis, but here's the odd thing. The death certificate said COVID-19. He was never tested. They didn't do an autopsy either. And in this person's opinion, this raised several issues." Now, this was just one account. And it was anecdotal, so I wasn't going to say anything about this last week. But since then, I have heard from a a consultant, an NHS consultant, that in fact this is happening quite often. And so I just want to highlight what's the response has been from Italy, the information from Italy over the last week or so. So here's Professor Walter Ricciardi, who's the scientific advisor to the Italian health minister, who is saying the way in which we code deaths in Italy is very generous, in the sense that all people who die in hospitals with the coronavirus are deemed to be dying of the coronavirus. And he went on to say, on re-evaluation by the National Institute of Health, only 12% of death certificates have shown a direct causality from coronavirus. So that paints quite a different picture with the Italian situation. And the question then, to my mind, Brian, is what does that say about what's happening in the UK? If we aren't going to actually identify specifically what people are dying from, then of course the picture can appear to be much worse than it is.
Well, I think it's shocking what's going on at the moment, Mike. Of course, we originally had Public Health England talking about 600,000 deaths. Now we've got 20,000. So these figures are just varying all over the place. And yet, if you dare challenge the statistics upon which the whole country's been shut down, then apparently you are challenging the truth put out by the BBC or the government, for example. We need to be asking a lot of questions here and pinning down the people producing the statistics and the data.
Yes. David, I'm keen to bring you in, but at this point I'm still not seeing any life from your audio feed, so it might be a good idea to drop the video link and re-establish, and let's see how we go there. But in the meantime, let's come on to this. This is Yale News from 2002, and the headline is "Rising Unemployment Causes Higher Death Rates, Yale Researcher Shows." And this is basically saying that unemployment is the essential element of social status, and it establishes a person as a contributing member of society, and also very important implications for self-esteem. When that is taken away, people become susceptible to depression, cardiovascular disease, AIDS, and many other illnesses that increase mortality. So this is a Professor Brenner. He is a PhD in medical sociology from Yale University, but he's a fellow at the Institute for Patient Safety. He's been associate professor of epidemiology and public health at Yale School of Medicine and Yale Department of Sociology. And he's held several visiting professorships at institutes including Yale, Harvard, Berlin University of Technology, and the Medical University of Hanover, Germany. So he published this. If anybody wants to go and find a bit more, I believe David's back with us now, which is good. And this is Harvey Brenner, estimating the social costs of national economic policy, implications for mental and physical health, and criminal aggression, and this was for the US Congress Joint Economic Committee, 94th Congress, in 1976. So he was talking about the period from 1940 to 1973. He said this, the relationship between unemployment and all-cause mortality found that unemployment increased the risk of dying by 63%. He said a 1% increase in the unemployment rate sustained over a period of 6 years has been associated with increases of 36,887 total deaths, including 20,240 cardiovascular deaths, 920 suicides, 648 homicides, 495 deaths from cirrhosis of the liver, 4,227 state mental hospital admissions, and 3,340 state prison admissions. This has been commented on by Robert Kennedy Jr. In this article on his website, "Will Despair Deaths of Despair Outpace Deaths from Coronavirus?" And he's saying, so how many additional deaths will be caused in the US by the increase of unemployment rate caused by government orders to shelter in place? That depends on a lot of factors, including the number unemployed and the length of unemployment. The official unemployment rate in February 2020, according to the US Bureau of Labor Statistics, was 3.5%. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin warned lawmakers of the possibility of a 20% unemployment rate from the coronavirus shutdowns unless Congress passes a $1 trillion stimulus plan, although he walked that statement back the next day. New Jersey, Pennsylvania and Minnesota report 10 to 12 fold increase in the filing of unemployment claims last week. So this, of course, is something that we've been trying to say for quite a bit of time now, that the effect of the cure is potentially worse than the disease itself. And David, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this, because clearly this aspect of it, the effect on people's lives and the response from people in terms of their health and suicide and so on, this really isn't being discussed by the mainstream press at all at this point.
It's not, and the question is it being taken into account by those who are setting the policy? In Scotland, the chief medical officer is Miss Calderwood. She's a gynaecologist. That's her background. We're talking about huge social effects. We're talking about economic effects. There's no reason to believe that she knows anything about any of this any more than the average man or woman in the street, really. And there's certainly no indication that such concerns have factored into the decision making, because it's this enormous response to the virus and everything else is being ignored. Yes, the concern most certainly is, are we doing more harm than good?
Absolutely. Now let's come on to the Bank of England then, the Treasury and the Bank of England, because a letter was written to the banks last week by the Treasury and the Bank of England, dated the 25th of March 2020. It's vital that government, the regulators and industry continue to act together to mitigate the longer lasting effects of COVID-19 on jobs, growth and the UK economy. And so they go on. But this was the key paragraph. David, as far as I was concerned, a number of decisions taken by the regulators will ensure the financial system has the capacity to ensure the uninterrupted supply of credit to the firms and households that need it. These include the reduction of the countercyclical capital buffer to 0%, supervisory guidance reminding firms to make use of their capital and liquidity buffers as necessary, the Bank of England's statement on provisioning under relevant accounting standards, and the decision to cancel the 2020 stress test and to amend the timetable for the biennial exploratory scenario. The Bank of England and the FCA have also identified a number of other prudential and conduct measures that will be adapted or delayed in order to alleviate operational burdens on firms. So I'm hoping, David, since you know a little bit about economy and so on, that you can tell me or explain to me how effectively removing the regulatory frameworks under which the banks operate, removing the stress test and the need to hold capital reserves, is going to make the situation better.
Well, the underlying assumption here is this is the low point. This is as bad as it can possibly be. We can run the capital reserves down to zero. There is no reserves. We commit everything, as the banking industry commits everything. Battle of Britain-like, right? Everything's in the air. Everything goes. And that's okay because, but we have a problem. We don't know how long it's going to last. We haven't sorted any of the problems from the last crisis, and we've instead created a bubble and everything. So we're going to run the banking system down to have no reserves, and then we're in a situation where we've no way of knowing how long this will last. And then when it's over, we're likely to have triggered the greatest depression that we only postponed last time, and the banking industry will go into that with nothing to fight it with. That seems to be a little concerning.
Yes, and many people asking the question, is this what this man was concerned about? So this is Thomas Schäfer, Finance Minister of Germany's Hesse state, which of course, as Al Jazeera pointing out here, includes Frankfurt, which is the banking centre of Germany. He's been found dead near a railway track. The police believe that this was suicide, that he's jumped out in front of a train. And many people suggesting that this is because he was really struggling to cope with the economic effects of the shutdown in Germany. He's been people saying that he's been working night and day to try to ease the problems that German companies are facing as a result. And sadly, he has decided that he couldn't live with it at this stage, it appears, and he's taken his own life. I think we're going to see a bit more of this, David.
Well, this takes us to Kyle Bass, the hedge fund manager, and his way of assessing world economies. He's looking for some sort of metric where he could understand the stress a government and society were under. And he came up with the finance minister index. You count the number of finance ministers a country goes through, and that gives you an indication as to how stressed they are. And he was using this in the context of Japan, where one finance minister checked himself into a sanatorium for the mentally deranged after passing the budget, and another one committed suicide. So we seem to be seeing the same thing in Germany here. I think we should start to perhaps look at having a finance minister index as a more formal piece on the UK column news, Mike.
Okay. Well, look, we were talking last Monday about Peter Hitchens being really the only person in the mainstream press that's speaking out with a different narrative than the rest. And if we remember last week, there was a caveat under his article in the Sunday Mail. This week, the headline is, "There's powerful evidence this great panic is foolish, yet our freedom is still broken and our economy crippled."
Yeah, so Hitchens is now no longer the only voice speaking out here, but he's still one of the strongest. And he's speaking here again in the Mail, and he writes, "As I watched the Prime Minister order mass house arrest on Monday night, I felt revulsion, anger and grief, as anyone brought up when this was a free and well-governed country would. I also felt terribly alone. You could not have known from anything broadcast last night or printed the following day that anyone was unhappy with these events, but they were. So above all things this week, I would like to thank all the kind, perplexed people who've got in touch with me by so many means to say that they share my doubts about the government's handling of COVID-19. And he goes on to then quote a High Court judge at length, who's written in the Times, to outline, a retired High Court judge, to outline his concerns over the attack on liberty that's going on here, and the tendency for powers once provided to the state to endure long after the actual reason has ended. This judge cited the Emergency Powers Act from the Second World War, which weren't taken off the statute books till 1965 and were still used in practice until into the 1980s.
Hitchens is getting a lot of support, he says there, but he's also getting a lot of abuse. He seems to be handling that reasonably well.
He does. I mean, it's the usual unthinking, you're costing people lives, you are morally reprehensible, this type of stuff, which anyone who asks questions on this should expect. But he does seem to be handling it well. He's been a lone voice often enough. I think he's well practiced at this, that once you've thought the issue through for yourself and you have a point of view to make, then as long as it's made carefully and thoughtfully, the unthinking response doesn't tend to cause too much consternation.
Yes. So in terms of other voices, we've got The Spectator. "How deadly is the coronavirus? It's still far from clear."
Yeah. Now, this is written by Dr. John Lee. Now, he's a retired professor of pathology and former NHS consultant pathologist. So he's saying, well, there's so much about this we just don't know. He concludes the article, says, "In the next few days and weeks, we must continue to look critically and dispassionately at the COVID-19 evidence as it comes in. Above all else, we must keep an open mind and look for what is and not for what we fear might be." So this again is one of many voices now speaking out to say that this has been a huge reaction, potentially a huge overreaction, and we need to have calm and reasoned examination of the evidence and to think through an appropriate response and not simply this headlong plunge into totalitarianism, because, well, that'll fix things, you know. It's this the problem of when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Why does the Bank of England just print money? Why does the government go for huge grabs of power and control of the population? It's because it's all they have, it's all they can do. And there's no thought, there's just this knee-jerk reaction. So here you see a former consultant pathologist question this. And also we've got the columnist in The Sun now coming out. He's describing this as hysteria. Trevor Kavanagh, hysteria has forced the UK into lockdown, crashed the economy, and will kill more than coronavirus. And this is, of course, the great risk that the solution will be worse than the cure. He says of Boris Johnson, this is Boris Johnson, one of the latest victims of the insidious virus, insists he always acts on scientific advice. We'll maybe talk about that more in the after section. He's written to every householder asking us to carry on self-isolating. As soon as he's well enough, he should make the political choices and tackle the COVID craziness before it does more real damage. As soon as the NHS has enough ventilators, hazmat suits and testing kits to take control of the epidemic, he must do two things. First, he must release the brake and get the economy going again. Labour will go mad, of course. But we need the people back at work, earning a living, keeping firms and high streets alive. And then the PM must halt the ghastly new emergency laws which license Jobsworth cops to run amok, track dog walkers by drone, bell at harmless citizens and urge us to spy on our neighbours. A good point. I can't say I've got any great confidence that Boris Johnson is going to do either of those two things.
No, but in the meantime, the BBC, well, what are they up to?
Well, it's interesting. The BBC, it's you know, fake news BBC, coronavirus, how to understand the death toll. And they go through this, and first they show the graph with 510,000 deaths. The crazy, my opinion, crazy figure to come out of Imperial College. There's no evidence that that's anywhere near reasonable. And then it says, well, it could be 250,000. No, it could be 20,000. And then when you go further in, it starts talking in the following views. It says, if it turns out to be as deadly as flu, and 1% of the people are infected, the upper limit of what we should be aiming for, the number of extra deaths will be under 1,400, which is about 5% of a typical flu season. So, you know, this is tiny. It may be more virulent than flu. So researchers mapped different scenarios, which means multiplied by a number. If it was five times as deadly, a reasonable estimation, researchers said there could be 6,900 excess deaths. So these are very small numbers, and they're essentially guesses. I mean, the BBC article describes these as models, but are they really models, or are they really just stabs in the dark? Because if we're talking from anything from 1,400 to 510,000, I'm not sure that this modelling-led approach is necessarily providing a clearer vision of what the country should be doing.
I think if we look at how models have been used, let's use climate change as an example. I'm not seeing any evidence that the computer models are providing any useful policy whatsoever. And there are many, many questions to be asked about the use of computer models in these types of situations, David.
Well, exactly. And this has been long recognised as a problem. Professionally, I deal with computer models the whole time, and you have to understand the limitations. And this goes back to Alfred North Whitehead, a mathematician in the early part of the 20th century, who described the problem in the terms of the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, which is the fallacy of confusing a computer model with the reality it purports to describe. And this has been recognized for well over 100 years as a problem. But we don't seem to have the people who are making decisions today in high positions of power realizing the limitations of computer modeling and realizing what you have to do in order to protect yourself from serious error, which is look for real world examples to test the model and ensure and constantly question the validity of the model and constantly revisit the validity of the model in order to ensure that what you're modeling is in fact somehow close to reality and not simply driving you down the route of a huge and catastrophic mistake.
Well, if you dare challenge all those figures, you get attacked. This is Helen Bevan, who's the NHS lead transformation officer. And she put out a tweet saying that there's such rubbish about COVID-19 conspiracy theories, etc., being spread by social media. I've blocked and muted a number of accounts because I can't bear to read it. The worst thing is it could kill people. And then there's advice. Don't engage, block them, message privately and tell them to stop. Report always report to a higher authority. That's always powerful. Instead, spread official advice. Well, there is a woman who's obviously spent more time with a little pussy cat than actually dealing with the true facts. But that is a worrying mindset, David. And I know that you've encountered that lady before in some of her other transformation work inside the BBC.
Well, this we're seeing quite a number of comments this on social media, extremely aggressive, argumentative and almost threatening policing of thought by members of the population who are so consumed by fear that they're just repeating the government line and cannot bear to hear a question raised.
Yes, okay. Now, just very briefly, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. There are options to do that there. Now, we're rapidly running out of time, so let's move on to this. This is a post in Open Democracy, and the headline is "The Coronavirus Crisis Shows It's Time to Abolish the Family." Now, this is written by Sophie Lewis, who describes herself as an author and a freelance writer interested in queer communism. Based in Philadelphia, and due to the coronavirus, she has lost 3 months' worth of income from speaking gigs, right? She says the first and darkest problem with the directive to stay at home is simply this: not everyone possesses access to a private dwelling. Amongst those of us who do have private homes, a huge proportion are not safe there, and being unable to leave only multiplies the threat. A quarantine is, in effect, an abuser's dream. A situation that hands near infinite power to those with the upper hand over a home. In short, the pandemic is no time to forget about family abolition. In words of feminist theorist and mother Madeleine Lane McKinley, households are capitalism's pressure cookers. The crisis will see a surge in housework, cleaning, cooking, caretaking, but also child abuse, molestation, intimate partner rape, psychological torture, and more. Far from a time to acquiesce to family values ideology, then, the pandemic is an acutely important time to evacuate and generally empower survivors of and refugees from the nuclear household. And she says that when the private nuclear household poses no direct physical or mental threat to one's person, no spouse battering or child rape, no queer bashing, the private family mode of social reproduction still frankly sucks. It genders, nationalizes and races us. It norms us for productive work. It makes us believe we are individuals. It minimizes costs for capital while maximizing human beings' life-making labor across boxes, billions of tiny boxes, each kitted out absurdly with its own kitchen, micro creche and laundry. It blackmails us into mistaking the only sources of love and care we have for the extent of what is possible. We do not know yet if we will be able to wrench something better than capitalism from the wreckage of this plague and the upcoming depression. I would only posit with some certainty that in 2020, the dialectic of families against the family, of real homes against the home, shall intensify. So, David, I thought that was amazing.
Amazing indeed. It shows the links there between queer theory, feminism, and socialism, and how they all view the family as something to be destroyed and equate it with capitalism, or more correctly, I think, with freedom. And did one of her complaints say the family makes us believe we're individuals? Well, amen to that.
Yes, well, on the same page then, David, this was posted by Open Democracy because they have a petition running. The petition is to Rishi Sunak, Chancellor of the Exchequer. They say, "We welcome the steps already taken by the government to support people and businesses affected by the coronavirus, but today we're calling on the government to introduce an immediate livable income guarantee for everyone living in the UK without conditions on job seeking, migration status, savings, partner income or any other limiting factors. This must guarantee every adult in this country an income equivalent to the real living wage, £9.30 per hour or £372 per week. It's grossly unjust that the most vulnerable in our society are hit hardest by this pandemic. To save lives now, we must urgently catch everyone in the safety net." What is that safety net?
It's the universal basic income again, right? Because it keeps failing, but never let a good crisis go to waste, because we couldn't persuade anyone of this crackpot scheme before. where money created out of nothing, and remember, money is work, so someone's got to actually earn something and do something somewhere along the complex line that is the economy. No, it's going to be created for thin air by the government and distributed, and what could go wrong with that? It's crackpottery in economic terms, and it is also the end to liberty, because, of course, if your only means of survival is a handout from the government, then the government will tell you what to do and what to think and what to say, and you better do what you're told.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that, David. Of course, it's the government aided by agencies that the government likes to have helping. And of course, that involves the media and people behind the media. Is there an attack on the family? Well, we think so, because if you're locked up at home, the government's now worried about your mental health, but also your relationship. So here's the Mail. I'm not going to dwell on this because people can find this online. But whether you're happy together or finding it hell, now's the time to rip up the relationship rule book, says a top couples therapist who shares his expert's tip for love in the time of corona. So this is pretty poisonous stuff. Encourage you to go and have a look at it. This is one example he gives. You're upset. Shouldn't a loving partner try to make it better? At first sight, this sounds true, but coming to your rescue might create problems. Perhaps, for example, to help combat your fears about the coronavirus or the impact of it on your finances, he dismisses them, saying you're overreacting. Alternatively, when you're angry with him, maybe he tries to rescue the situation by giving you a hug. However, you feel he's, quote, minimizing your emotions and push him away. This is very, very toxic stuff by this self-appointed marital expert. I won't leave it too much, but on screen too long, but do go and have a look at the article and really think about the very dark ideas that this man is putting into people's heads, aided by the Mail.
Yeah, and well, the police also, well, what are they doing? Let's have a look at this. This is Stephen Kinnock MP, who tweeted this out on Saturday. Dad turned 78 today. Of course, that's Neil Kinnock. Incredible but true. So he took a couple of chairs over, sat in their front garden for a socially distanced celebration, as you do. Happy birthday, mate. That was what he tweeted out. In response, he gets a reply from South Wales Police, who say, "Hello, Stephen Kinnock. We know celebrating your dad's birthday is a lovely thing to do. However, this is not essential travel. We all have our part to play in this. We urge you to comply with Gov UK restrictions. They are in place to keep us safe. Thank you." He responded in turn by saying, "I felt that it was essential travel as I had to deliver some necessary supplies to my parents. I stayed long enough to sing happy birthday to Dad and then it was off. All the best, Stephen." So I thought we would just briefly have a look at some of the responses on Twitter. The responses underneath just went on forever, but here's the first one. 1984 was a warning, not a blueprint. Then we have somebody saying, "Looking after vulnerable relatives is indeed essential. So well done, Stephen. You delivered essential supplies. Checked they were okay, all from a safe distance. South Wales Police, you should be disgusted with your post. Doing your force no favours and will lose respect from the public." Then somebody saying, "Disgusting, sneering response by South Wales Police to a good-natured tweet by Stephen Kinnock, showing condescending attitude and waste of police time." Then think you're forgetting about this is a democracy. Are you saying Stephen is breaking the law? It's not the job of the police to express an opinion on health advice. Stephen is an elected MP. It's his job to give an opinion on health advice. Somebody saying, "I urge you to shut the hell up and show us where in the new regulations does it prohibit non-essential travel. Millions of workers will be heading to construction and other sites tomorrow." Somebody saying, "And so it continues. A police force bullies an MP and tries to shame him for visiting his elderly parents on his father's birthday with supplies for upkeep of their home. The lack of knowledge of the law on show is beyond belief." Another one, "Hello, South Wales Police. Where in the regulations is essential travel defined, please?" And so it goes on. "Are you monitoring people on Twitter? Does South Wales Police have Twitter police? How do you know his trip to his parents wasn't essential? Maybe he's bringing supplies to his parents and chose that day so he could wish them happy birthday in person." And so the responses went on, David. And there are a couple of very important points there. First of all, we are increasingly seeing the police operating outside the law because they are insisting that certain things are not permitted, when in fact the constitutional position in this country, we'll say it again, is that everything is permitted unless it is prohibited by law in this country. That's how that is the nature of our relationship with the state as individuals. But the police seem to be taking it upon themselves to decide what we can and can't do outside of what is given by the law.
Yes, we talked about this on Extra Time some weeks ago, that policy, government policy, has become de facto law. Well, it's now gone a stage further, because what we're seeing here is official announcement has become de facto law. There doesn't seem to be anything else needed. And the police seem to be rushing to comply.
Yes. So just very quickly, David, what's the situation in Scotland then?
I was just pointing out some nice fake news by STV here. Police fine 25 people for gathering in public places. The police can't fine anybody. Only the courts can fine people. The police have no such power. And it's only when you get into the detail of the article that it admits actually it was a fixed penalty notice. And delivering a notice is something people can't ignore. It's not a fine. These two things are completely different legally. So here we're seeing both Police Scotland and STV pushing the idea that the police have powers that they do not have.
Yes, and so we'll end the programme then on a couple of memes, because I think this is it's important to see how people are reacting to this stuff. And here we have Stalin, and the text that goes with it: is everyone enjoying their free 30-day trial of communism?
That'll be queer communism, though.
Yes, indeed.
And the last one here is a Venn diagram with Fahrenheit 451, 1984, Brave New World, and The Handmaid's Tale all overlapping. And in the middle of the overlap, in amongst Soylent Green and Lord of the Flies, it says, "You are here."
Yes. So I guess we'll have to leave that there.
Yeah, amazing. I'll just add by saying, over the weekend, I did go out for my exercise, which I'm permitted to do. I was just fascinated, no eye contact from most people. So you have people desperately trying to keep 2 metres apart, people who would cross the road so they didn't have to pass another individual. This is a massive attack on people's psychology and humanity itself. Or seeing people standing in a bitterly cold wind 2 metres apart outside the local doctor's surgery in order to go in and collect things from the pharmacy. Mm. This is madness. And my personal opinion I'm just going to give is that we are watching, yes, there's a winter flu virus that's been hyped up in order to produce a massive lockdown to see how far people will go. And it's a very long way. And of course, we got the economic thing coming in the backdrop. So a couple of people said to me, "We just got a feeling that things are never going to be the same when this thing is over." And I smiled to myself and thought, yep, that's exactly what it's designed to do if we let it. And of course, we mustn't allow it to do so. David, thanks very much. And thank you to all our viewers and listeners. If you like what we're doing and you think it's important, please share it and pass it on in order to get round to the censorship of people like NHS Horizons and others. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.